This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Okay, welcome everyone. As I said at the opening, my name is Patrice Pietro and I'm here tonight with Professor Carol Stabile to talk about the two pieces of radio and television that we've just watched. As I said at the beginning, tonight's event is part of our year-long series devoted to the theme of panic. As many of you know, our series aims to explore rather than incite panic. This isn't about inciting panic, but rather trying to understand older media so as to what the past might tell us about the moral and political panics in our own time. And it's remarkable how a lot of these things are very recursive and repetitive. I thought of Carol's work immediately when we were planning for this series, since her most recent book, The Broadcast 41, Women in the Anti-Communist Backlash, explores how television and popular culture landed in the crosshairs of those quick to ban, blacklist, and censor. In fact, when I was first thinking about this series, I wanted to do canceled, censored, blacklisted, banned. And then our group, our little programming team, said it was too many words. And so we picked one, panic, with an exclamation point to kind of be a covering term. Actually, too, as I've said to other people, when I looked at banned films, it was like, they're really bad. And I didn't really want to do The Human Centipede or, you know, some horrible. So panic seemed a more salient term for what we were wanted to look at. So with that said, Carol, can you tell us how you came to this study and where did your research lead you? How did you start?
That's a great question. My research started more years ago than I would like to admit. I was thinking a lot about family values in television at a point in time when family values is very much in the news. And it struck me that the politicians and pundits who talked about family values often used images from 1950s television. Instead of referring to their own families, which actually that makes sense, right? Because their families weren't exactly poster children for the family values that they were espousing. So I started thinking about the people who told the stories, the perspectives that were sort of being institutionalized in the 1950s. There's a historian named Stephanie Kuntz who talks about how Leave It to Beaver was treated as if it was a documentary rather than a sitcom. So I started thinking about who was making the media at that point in time, who was doing the writing. My background is in literature and in media. And so I really wanted to think about like, what were the conditions in which they were writing, who was doing the writing, whose perspectives were on offer. And in a circuitous way, it kind of led me to The Blacklist because I started thinking about what was going on in the late 1940s and in the early 1950s. And at every stage, I encountered people, writers, performers, directors, whose careers just ended in or about 1949 or 1950. So that led me, as I was doing the research on my book, and it's the kind of book you can only do when you have tenure because it took a very long time, I started filing Freedom of Information Act requests for all the files of the women who are listed in this one pamphlet known as the Bible of the Blacklist. It was called Red Channels, the Report on Communist Influence in Radio and Television. So I filed all of these Freedom of Information Act requests. If anyone knows how long it takes to do that, if you don't have a whole legal team behind you, it is the work of decades. And so as they started trickling in, I got a really good sense of why these people were being targeted and why their work was being defined as subversive. Because it was in the pages of the FBI files, it was in the writings of anti-communists, and they weren't very subtle about it either. And there was a lot of traffic too between the Federal Bureau of Investigation and then this emerging private security industry, as well as veterans organizations and a kind of unholy alliance between the Catholic Church and prominent Jewish industrialists with ties to China. So that's the short version of how I got interested in it. I focused more recently on CBS because anti-communists really converged on that network hard in 1949, in 1950. And some of the files I've gotten more recently clearly lay out the terms of that retaliation and how it functioned. And of course, given what's going on in the world right now, I'm thinking a lot about retaliation, about how retaliation works in media industries and what sort of effects it produces, especially over the longer term.
Well, apropos of what we've just listened to and seen, why did you select these two texts? Just to remind you, a radio broadcast from 1943 featuring William Robeson's open letter on race hatred, and a screening of this 1951 episode of The Goldbergs.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. Well, I chose them for a number of different reasons. One was Bill Robeson's open letter on race hatred was in 1943, but it appears again and again in the FBI files and in the comments of anti-communists as evidence of communist influence in subversive behavior. Because for anti-communists, mention of, especially in broadcasting, of racism was always seen as evidence of a communist plot to subvert America. And so they really did not forget that Bill Robeson had done that program. It won a Peabody. And it was critically acclaimed work on television. And so I wanted folks to see what it was. It was drawing that kind of attention. The other part of the Bill Robeson story is that Bill Robeson is fired in 1950. He's one of three members of CBS's documentary unit who are fired. The FBI and their anti-communist allies are really clear that documentary is in and of itself a subversive form, right? I think J. Edgar Hoover says in one memo that, of course, you know, if you have a documentary, people are always slanting it, right? That was part of the language that they use, right? They're always slanting it to criticize the United States. So that's the Robeson piece, and I think it's also interesting too because it's 1943 in the midst of the war. The Double V campaign is going on. The Double V campaign was a campaign started by a black newspaper called the Pittsburgh Courier, and it was meant to promote fighting fascism both in the United States and abroad. So that's the Robeson piece. Again, they clean house in late 1950, and so the whole documentary unit gets dismantled at that point in time. Gertrude Berg is also interesting because it's hard to think of her as a sort of communist operative, right? She's the consummate pitch woman, right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's amazing. She's an incredible pitch woman. She's just this massively successful businesswoman. She writes, directs, and produces 35 years worth of programming. There's this great picture of her with scripts stacked around herself. But the Goldbergs was also a target of anti-communist attention for a number of different reasons. One was it's an ethnic sitcom, right? That is very different from the vision of America that anti-communists were promoting. And you could see it that, right? You could see how different it is also from what comes later, the heavily accented English. What I love about that episode too is like its attention to social anxiety, right? Like the whole family is like, what do we call each other? And if you teach classes, you know that students are always anxious about what to call you. So it's this universal kind of anxiety. It's a multi-generational household, right? That is it's in a tenement, right? You've got Uncle David. So there are all these things about the sitcom that mark it as being very different from, Leave It to Beavers, The Father Knows Best, and the kinds of sitcoms that occur later. But it also, Ruth, not Ruth, Gertrude Berg was also known as being a great employer and having a very kind of family-friendly set. She attracted a lot of talent. She was an incredible mentor to writers and to other aspiring actors and actresses. But Philip Loeb, who played Jake in the series, the father, had been in the targets of anti-communists for nearly a decade at that point. He was one of the co-founders of Actors Equity. He was really prominent in sort of jurisdictional reorganizations within the unions that were serving television in the late 1940s. And anti-communists were constantly calling him, they were constantly saying he was a member of the Communist Party. It was this refrain that really kind of dogged him. As far as I can tell, and even the FBI files say this too, he was never a member of the Communist Party, but he was a high profile target. So and Patrice mentioned this in the intro, they told Gertrude Berg that she should fire him. And for 2 years, she fought the network and she did everything she could to keep him on the show. Finally, what it came down to is they were going to cancel the show if she didn't let him go. And he left at that point in time and committed suicide 2 years later. You know, again, the Bureau and the anti-communists, they knew a lot about people and they knew a lot about the kinds of pressure that they could bring to bear on people. Philip Loeb had an adult son who was severely mentally ill. He was institutionalized. Philip Loeb was his sole support. You know, they knew the pressure points and they figured out to, you know, how to apply those. So I wanted to have those two very, very different episodes to show you just how wide the range was of what anti-communists and the bureaus were going after. And to also kind of hint at what would become impossible after 1950. And after the industry had really, really gotten nervous about having any kind of programming that could be described as controversial.
Yeah, and it's also striking during the war and then after, and how quickly from 49 to 51, all of this came to pass. To me, it's always, I'm struck by how quickly things can change.
Well, talk about panic. I mean, this is a moment, you know, in the periods after the end of wars are always periods where societies are reorganizing. Mm-hmm. And I think then, you know, the entry of the U.S. into the Korean conflict really amplified the anxiety and the fear that anti-communists were promoting, that we were on the verge of a communist takeover in the United States.
Well, in another significant pairing of text, you begin your book by comparing an early episode of the Lucy Desi Comedy Hour, the successor to the iconic sitcom I Love Lucy, with an episode titled Lucy Wants a Career. And you pair that with another show by blacklisted producer and director Adrian Scott entitled Ellie, Payday, or The Wayward Wife. So why are these two conflicting stories about women's roles central to your argument about gender and class in television in the post-war period?
Yeah. You know, again, it's a sense of very different possibilities for the future of American television that were kind of in the air at that point in time. Lucy Wants a Career is an episode that's about Lucille Ball is, you know, confides in Ethel Mertz, her neighbor, some of you will know, that she's sick of doing the cooking and the cleaning and the dusting, and she really wants to have a career again. And so she convinces Ethel to take over the homemaking in the house, and she hops on a train to Manhattan and interviews for a job as a Girl Friday, which is basically a personal assistant. She's confronted when she gets there, and it's very funny because Lucille Ball is very funny. She's confronted with all these young starlets who are much younger than she is. They're beautiful, they're polished. And she tells them all that the man that they are they're interviewing with is a sexual harasser, a wolf. And so she scares them all off. So she's the only person left and she gets a job. But then, you know, she's very successful. The network who hires her loves her. They put her on the air. But when she goes home one night, she's talking to little Ricky, and little Ricky calls Ethel mommy. And of course, that's another the moment where everything changes, right? Where she's like, I'm giving up so much. My child doesn't even recognize me as my mother. I hate my job. I don't want to work anymore. So she and Big Ricky, you know, manage to get out of her contract. And she says, well, this is great. I can go home and I'm going to take a pill and then I'm going to sleep until noon, which is weird because, you know, any middle class mother is not going to take a pill and sleep till noon. So that's one episode, and it was written by two men who became very successful in television. The other episode, as you mentioned, is by Adrian Scott, and it was a script that he was shopping around. One of the things that I did as part of this, my research, is I spent a lot of time in archives looking for scripts that hadn't been produced. I looked for the things that people wanted to make, but they hadn't been able to make. And this was a script that Adrian Scott had shopped for 3 to 4 years under a pseudonym because he was blacklisted. So he couldn't write under his own name. He was writing under the name of Richard Sandville. And it was about a woman, Ellie, married to Al. They have two children. And one day she just gets sick of it. She says, you know, I'm really tired of this. I don't get any salary for doing all the work in the house. I don't get any time to myself. I'm not recognized as a worker. You all take me for granted. And my husband is emotionally distant. So she leaves. She leaves the house. She leaves the kids and goes and lives somewhere else. Of course, Al then has to discover what it's like to run a household and to take care of the two kids. She and Al reconcile, of course. But not before he's agreed to pay her $75 a week, give her two nights off so she could go to college and pay into Social Security so that she can enjoy Social Security benefits. So it's just really, it's a very kind of progressive. And then at the end, Al loses his job. And I think she says to him something like, he really finally understood what it was like to be on the bottom with someone sitting on you. So it was this really very kind of Marxist understanding of like women's unwaged labor and what it was like to do that work and how it was not recognized socially. At one point, Ellie goes to the government and they're like, well, you don't have any job experience. Like, you don't have any work experience and you haven't worked before. And she's like, wait a minute. She said, I've been working for the last 20 years in the household. So of course, he never was able to get that produced, right? He kept shopping it around, never happened. The script is still there. You know, and so it is these very different perspectives on women's lives, women's labor, and really family structure in the United States. One of them that prevailed, and again, the other that was just buried in an archive. And there are lots of scripts like that, right? There are lots of other kinds of things. One of the women I wrote about, Freddie Washington, who was just incredible. She was a dancer, a performer, a labor activist, a journalist. And for years, she had these two scripts, one about Nat Turner's uprising and the other about Denmark Vesey's uprising. These are both enslaved people's uprisings that she had been shopping around for years and years. This is like 50, 60 years before it even became thinkable again to create scripts or programming like that. So it really shows you just how things got stalled. Yeah. And how a whole range of progressive discourse about race, about class and gender got shut down.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about, you're talking largely about the blacklist and you've just talked about these scripts and that weren't produced. But what about certain individual women and what happened to them?
Yeah, yeah.
The 41, and you have in your book on the sleeve, and it has a list of everyone that you're considering.
I think the first thing to mention is that the outcomes are really different depending on race. There are five African-American women who are blacklisted, who are listed in red channels. And blacklisting and those sorts of attacks were just part of their professional lives. It had been constant. I'm thinking here of Shirley Graham Du Bois. She married W.E.B. Du Bois. But she begins her career. She's the first Black woman to write and produce an opera in the United States. She then goes on to, she becomes the only Black woman to direct a federal Negro theater project in Chicago. That gets shut down by the blacklist, by a blacklist. She then goes to work for the YMCA. Her work there, she's fired because anti-communists converge on her. She becomes this very popular writer of adolescent fiction. One of the things she really wants to do is restore histories of people of color to American history. And of course, it is of course to me because I'm so immersed in this world, anti-communists consider Black history a communist plot.
Well, they still do.
Yeah, they still do. Right? Yeah.
Sorry, 1619.
Yeah. No, I write.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a historian, so I like to stay in my period. I'm not a political scientist, but I think that's right. So she loses her contract because they converge on her again. Finally, she and W.E.B. Du Bois leave the United States for Ghana because they simply can't get work. And because at every turn they're confronted with these forces of censorship.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So in your book, you also talk about this notion of G-man masculinity. I mean, it's your term, mm-hmm. but you're trying to talk about Cold War security state and what kind of new masculine ideal emerged. So could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. G-man masculinity, it's so interesting because the FBI was really concerned about public image. They were very concerned about public image from the beginning. J. Edgar Hoover had a PR department. They called it the Crime Records Division, so no one knew really what it was. But their job was to create media and to promote media and to also establish relationships with friendly journalists so that they could control the image of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and its agents. Richard Gid Powers has this great book that's just about, he has a whole chapter where he just talks about the kind of multimedia empire that the Bureau created, right? They had comic books for boys. They had television shows. They had, all manner of media that they were producing. And in fact, some later FBI agents will talk about that in their accounts of why they became agents, right? It was like, well, we saw G-Man, or we were reading the G-Man comic books and it looked so cool. So when I say G-Man masculinity, it really is a kind of media creation that was deployed very strategically, to promote the image of the FBI and its sort of scientific crime fighting prowess. It was also deeply segregationist, right? It was very, very sexist, extraordinarily racist. The Bureau did not hire people of color or women to become special agents until they were forced to later in the 1960s when Hoover's power was waning. When I talk about G-man masculinity, I think the thing that I've thought about a lot since I wrote the book that probably wasn't as obvious to me then as it was now is that it was also a very fear-based kind of project, right? I feel like there was a lot of, a lot of the sense that, that masculinity had to be protected, that it was under threat, whether it was under threat because of communists who were trying to undermine 100% Americanism. Maybe it was under threat because, at various points, women were trying to horn in on sort of traditional provinces of masculine power. But I think at the end of the day, that is one of the reasons it had so much staying power, is it really spoke to these anxieties about change and about people losing something. people losing privilege because of those changes.
Yeah. I was just thinking about what I was reading in the New York Times today, but I won't go there.
Okay.
All about how young men don't know how to be men anymore, how we need to restore this. In any event,
has anyone seen The Apprentice?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, because The Apprentice, like these are the people. This is the playbook, right? This is the playbook, and it's not a really smart or original playbook, but it's the playbook. And I think it's important, even though I'm not a political scientist, I would say it's important to know where the playbook came from, and that is the playbook.
Right, even if maybe a political scientist couldn't tell us that much either.
Sure.
But what I wanted to follow up with you is something we talked about as we were preparing for tonight's event, and talking to various journalists who wanted to promote it in the local news, and they kept wanting to say, "How's this related to now? How's this related to now? Right? Is this the same as what's going on right now?" And you want to say, yes, no, it's complicated. I can't give you a blurb. That wouldn't be a responsible way to talk about this.
Yeah.
But I have this question for you. So I say, can you say more, as someone who studied this, about anti-communist legacies today? In your book, you say, and I quote, "In the years following the end of World War II, as relations of gender, race, and nation were in flux, political forces in the U.S. competed for control over the stories that would appear on the powerful new medium of television, and the ability to define and represent America and Americanism. The broader narrative about Americanism that resulted from this conflict reflected not so much the spontaneous desires of millions who watched the new media as it did a common sense of groups of men who had long dominated American politics and culture." So, I mean, with thinking about this, the work does resonate today.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted you to say a little bit more about, are we in a period of, if you read various news sources and Substack and everything else, there's a notion there that we are on the precipice of entering some new moment. And of course, those of us who are historians, you know that the new moments are also the old moments, and that change itself, I mean, maybe the problem is that people think that what history is change, but in fact, it's not. So could you say more about that?
Yeah. I think one of the things, we'll talk about the through line first, that I think is important about thinking about this era is, again, the forms of retaliation and the pressures that were brought to bear on people to toe this line. Because this was really about quashing dissent. This was a social movement that understood criticism as being treasonous. I keep going back in my brain to that old schoolyard axiom, right? You could dish it out, but you can't take it. And it feels
see it to my face.
Yeah. It feels a lot like that, right? That to criticize the United States, to criticize U.S. policy at that point in time was tantamount to treason, right? Because they were very concerned about the PR war, especially with the escalating conflict in Southeast Asia. They didn't want publicity to the race problem. So I heard a little bit about that in the Bill Robson broadcast. All of those forms of critique were understood to be efforts to undo America. And so I feel like we're entering into a moment where at least we can see the retaliation. I think what was so terrifying for people during this period is that you didn't know, right? And you didn't share any of that information, right? Television was from the perspective of control, it was a lot easier to control TV than it is to control the internet and to control the flow, for better or for worse. That old gatekeeping model meant that, once you kind of had control of that, it was really hard to air other viewpoints. So I think understanding the mechanisms of retaliation, understanding the way in which criticism is being weaponized, against us is if criticism is a core to democracy, right? I mean, the only way that anti-communists understood criticism was as a destructive act. When really, like, that best part of criticism, and you know this as an academic, is like, oh, I didn't think of that, right? Or maybe there's a better way of doing something, and that criticism is going to help me figure out how to do that. So I think that that's one of the through lines. And again, just knowing that this isn't original, I think sometimes, you know, as a historically minded person, I get really nervous when people say, we've never been this polarized, for example, right? Like all the talk about polarization. We were pretty polarized in the 1950s, regardless of what you saw on the television screen. This was a deeply polarized nation, right? And that was a hugely dangerous moment that had so many terrible ramifications for people in South America, for people in Asia, for people in Africa. So I think we forget at some risk that there are these continuities. Then I think the other thing is that the other piece of this that I think a lot about is that the work of change is a work of lifetimes. You know, in an era of immediate gratification, maybe we forget that sometimes. But it's like you were saying, you have to keep at the work, right? And they're going to push you back. And, you know, it's Dr. King's birthday that we'll be celebrating later this week, also a holiday that was fought virulently by anti-communists. You know, the arc of justice is long, but I think you've got to push it toward justice. And that's why I like remembering the stories of people who did that work before us, because I find them inspiring and strangely reassuring.
Yeah.
That's one of my last questions for you. And I think I know that in the book you want to talk about what was lost and what was never made, but you also want to talk about stories of resilience and hope, because there were people who kept at it. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us more about certain figures you think fought the fight? They might have lost, but they worked to see another day.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Freddie Washington is a great example of that. Freddie Washington had, she was in an all-black cast production of The Lysistrata in the mid-1940s. She worked on Broadway for a long time. She was blacklisted. She was also on the Goldbergs. She played a maid on the Goldbergs. And she said the only reason she would play a maid on the Goldbergs was if she got to rewrite the dialogue. And she did rewrite, like you can look through the scripts and see all the places in which Freddie Washington has revised the dialogue. But anyway, she also did this amazing criticism for the People's Voice, a newspaper in New York City. It was media criticism in which she took Hollywood to task for the racism. She had a powerful platform, you know, for up until 1945, 1946 to do that work. And she remained really upbeat and committed to the struggle and supportive of other people for the rest of her life. Hazel Scott's another example. Hazel Scott was, she was a performer, an actor, a very, very famous pianist, married to Adam Clayton Powell. And she used her celebrity to bring a landmark civil rights case against a restaurant in Tacoma, Washington, that refused to serve her and the person she was working with. And, you know, for the rest of her life, which was unfortunately too short, she remained committed to the struggle. She wound up in France for years, where she kept a house and took in women who were survivors of intimate partner violence. Shirley Graham, again, is I think she's the most incredible example, because here's someone who's blacklisted in at least four different industries. And when she goes to Ghana, she becomes the founder of the first television station, the first television system, right, in Ghana. So these are people, they knew that the fight was long. And some of them were members of the Communist Party, some of them weren't. And they knew the meaning of the word struggle.
Well, you told us about Philip Loeb and his untimely death. What about Gertrude Berg? What happened to her?
Gertrude Berg, she stayed on the air after they fired Philip Loeb. They forced her to move the setting of the sitcom to a suburb called Haverford. It didn't do very well. It's kind of sad to watch. I think I told you about an episode. One of the last episodes has her. She's surrounded by these waifish suburban women. And is feeling very bad that she can't lose weight. And in the last scene, it's so sad. She's in the kitchen eating spaghetti out of the pot, right? So it was really it felt very shaming. But she continued to work. She did a film called Molly Goldberg Goes to College. She was, you know, a lot of people got work in Broadway. Because the political economy of Broadway is so different, mm-hmm. that the blacklist wasn't in effect in the same ways. So she continued to do that work. She always had an eye out for new talent. She hired Eartha Kitt at one point. Wow. After she'd seen her on Broadway. So she kept that up until she also died young in the middle of the 1960s.
Wow. Well, it's at that point now we can open up for audience questions.
Hi, my name is Henry Lenz. Wow, I have so much to add to this discussion based on my career.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate. I worked with the next generation of actors and writers and producers after The Blacklist.
Oh.
But Hi Brown, who was this legendary radio producer, was the original Jake Goldberg. Mm-hmm. She heard him on Yiddish radio in Brooklyn in 1929, and she asked him to play Jake on the radio. And I became, well, basically two things. I became the technical director for CBS Radio's national documentary series. So I did that for about 20 years.
Yeah.
And we never did a show about The Blacklist. Nobody ever talked about it. Mm-hmm. We won two Peabody Awards for documentaries that were hosted by Charles Osgood. But that Blacklist story just never saw the light of day. I didn't know about Robeson. That was astonishing. He was so far ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And how very little has changed. Mm-hmm. Even with civil rights legislation in the 60s, there's still... the attitudes are still prevalent. They're hidden, but they're out there.
One thing I was going to mention, and it turns up in the FBI files. The FBI is very concerned about this. At a certain point in the late 19, I think it's like the early part of 1949, CBS is one of the networks that's talking about diversifying its newsroom. This is 20 years before the Kerner Commission, 18 years, close to 20 years before the Kerner Commission report. After the uprisings, and they're really worried because they're talking about bringing in commentators like W.E.B. Du Bois or Langston Hughes, imagine what that would have looked like, right? I mean, if you'd had some of them, you know, some prominent black intellectuals actually, you know, commenting on the news, and that's a battle, right? I mean, as you pointed out. Here we are 75 years later.
Thank you very much. This has been kind of breathtaking in all sorts of ways. I was struck by the initial piece, CBS basically telling folks that they didn't care what the word was, they were going to maintain their integrity. Mm-hmm. At the current time, we're seeing a lot of those same entities bending the knee, yeah. Which I think is very scary. Based upon your experience, what would you hope that we would be doing at this point in time to make sure that we have the strength, the courage, that the media, that the entertainment industry have the courage to keep presenting issues, keep retaining that diversity, keep challenging racism and bigotry, because it appears that so many are falling into line. And I just wonder what we might be able to do and what we can expect and demand in order to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's a huge one. I mean, by the end of 1950, CBS had bent the knee in the 1950s. And because I have access to those documents, I see all the pressures that were brought to bear on them that made that happen. That wasn't something that what they wanted to do, right? The network knew that they were going to lose money because of the blacklist, because they were going to lose really talented, creative people. But the economic and political pressures that were brought on them were immense. For me, the lesson of that is that, and a lawyer for John Henry Falk, who won a big, he won a landmark libel case against some of the blacklisters, his lawyer said nothing, he's quoting someone else, but he said nothing acts as scared as $1 million. And I think that for me, the economic pressure on commercial media, I don't have historical evidence that they will be willing to stand up to those pressures. So I would say we really have to support independent media. And we also have to think about the power of the threat of boycotts and letter writing campaigns. I mean, go to the defense of people who are being attacked. There's nothing, I mean, I think the thing that's the saddest about reading some of the papers was just how isolated people felt and how alone they felt. You know, and sometimes when you're brave in public, you get a lot of private emails and messages from people who are like, yeah, go girl, you know, you're great. But when it comes to standing up for other people in public, they don't do it. So those might sound like silly things, but I do think supporting independent media and then being willing to be courageous in the ways that you can be courageous as citizens is really key.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
One last.
You try.
In the first piece, the Columbia, there was a, despite of all the propaganda about, you know, equality and all that, it was loaded with a nationalistic idea of glorifying the army and America and all that, you know, kind of like a big propaganda for recruiting more black into the army. I just wanted to, my question is, you know, how do you compare that episode versus, you know, just the last year where more than 150 journalists been killed in occupied Palestine and the future that is coming up with, even if we thought McCarthyism was bad, you know, you haven't seen anything yet. I just wanted, if you can make a comment.
At least McCarthy could ultimately be shamed.
Yeah.
They say we're in a post-shame, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't, as a media scholar and historian, I don't know how to answer that question, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I think for me, as a citizen and as someone who cares deeply about the world, we have a political system that seems incapable of getting out of the violence that that's at the heart of it, right? I mean, and you know, this is something that really ramps up during the Cold War era, right, with the investment in militarism and the redirection of resources to aggression and to harming people rather than helping them. I don't know. I wish I had an answer to that question, but I don't. Sorry.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.